We're back with Frank Delaney. I'm Paula Gordon, Bill Russell. And oddly enough, a small little thing that goes through my life with me, it's about this big, maybe an inch and a half. It's a pig on which rides a little Irishman. This is my mother's gift to me, that one should always laugh. And as you talk about, I mean, a pig carrying a little person on it with a little funky hat, that's funny. Part of what I think both of you are talking about is this, in the midst of just incredible oppression, the Irish have been able to find something to laugh about to get them through. Don't you think that's part of this swath across the planet?
I hate to shatter this for you.
Uh-oh.
But I'm going to break it in little pieces.
Okay, I'll brace myself.
The pig was almost certainly made by an Englishman.
Uh-huh.
And the figure of an Irishman on a pig is as denigrating as any denigratory terms you have used for African Americans anywhere in the world.
So it would be denigrating of the Irish or of the pig?
Of the Irish.
Oh, I would have thought if the Irish was riding it, it would be denigrating of the English.
It was the highest they could ride.
Oh, now, my God.
Here's an interesting thing for you. If you look at the history of the social history of Boston and Chicago and parts of New York, or London, or Liverpool, or Birmingham, or Manchester, the notices in the boarding house windows were not no Irish or Negroes. It was no Negroes or Irish. And I'm fascinated by an American electoral statistic. I love American politics. I've been immersed in American politics since I was 15, 16 years old. I've followed more closely than is reasonable. I'm convinced that the Irish vote in America has never, in its own constituencies, gone to African-American candidates. Because there was a very long time when they were almost vying with each other for the lowest place on the totem pole and where to get out. And the pig was an English image created by Punch magazine in London when they couldn't beat us linguistically and they couldn't beat us militarily. They tried to beat us by association. So when they were unable to defeat us, they then began to associate us with the lowest
swine
forms of life. Absolutely. And I was involved for many years in London at the height of the bombings and the troubles, where I was a reporter for the BBC. I was involved in fighting, in pushing back the denigration of the Irish by a kind of racism. When the Race Relations Act in England was passed by the English government, the Irish were not included.
Amazing.
Amazing. So that was part of the late 19th century image of Paddy and the Pig. And if you go back to people like Currier and Ives, whose illustrations provide the jackets of my books, because they went to Ireland in the 19th century, they actually tried to produce posters to make this humorous. And that was the only thing of Currier Ives related to Ireland that did not sell in the Irish community. Mm-hmm. Where did it sell? Among the Boston Protestants.
So much for my funny, huh?
No. You should hold on to it. You should hold on to it because it gets better if you hold on to it and transform it. And that is a story.
A very close friend of mine did his dissertation on the Irish in New York City.
Yes.
And he being from Russian Jewish stock, I said, why would you, I mean, you've got all of these other stories, why would you go look at the Irish? And he said, because it's every story of oppression.
That's right. When Ireland came out, and I went on an author tour.
The book Ireland.
Yes, the book Ireland came out, Ireland, a novel, came out in 2005, and I went around the country. I naturally expected that the people who showed up at libraries and bookshops would be mostly Irish. No, shock. 40 to 50% maybe, but a huge number of Indonesians, Chinese, Polish, Eastern European, Latin American, because it was about story. I remember going to a library in Minneapolis, St. Paul, where 400 and something people showed up on a cold evening in March, and I asked people to raise their hands who had Irish blood in them, less than 50% of the audience. I was astounded. I assumed that I was working a niche, a sensible thing for a professional author to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you know, David McCullough does American history, whatever. Mm-hmm. This is a very sensible thing to do, in my view, as a profession. But then people started talking to me. It happened to me 2 weeks ago in Denver, where some Japanese people came up to me who had driven 40 miles to see me because it was about story. And when I did a series with the BBC called The Celts, the second highest audience outside the Celtic countries was in Japan, because these were island histories. Mm. And I think people need, your Jewish friend, your Russian Jewish friend in New York, I think people are looking for exemplars from history to latch on to, almost in a medallion sort of way, almost as something they can handle and feel and touch, almost as an amulet, saying, if a country like this can have a history, then I can quarry my own history and find out what it is that made me. And the Irish and the Jews, of course, very close affinity, if only for the fact that the Kellys and the Coens, they said, around Hollywood. You know?
Well, that's no joke.
Well, what you call a medallion, I think of, is myth, is those deep, profound stories that define who and what we are. We're all now so thoroughly displaced, or so many of us are displaced, that those stories become very important. It also, I think, you can't talk about Ireland ultimately without talking about the politics of Ireland. Mm. A few years back, we had the opportunity to have a long conversation with a fellow who was one of the founders of SASO, the South African Students Organization, and had been essentially a freedom fighter, and had, you know, a much longer story, but had been involved in that struggle for freedom and for democracy.
And his name is Barney Pityana.
And within a month of that conversation, we had a conversation with Jerry Adams.
A most intelligent man.
Indeed. A very intelligent and charming.
Charming man.
And at the end of those two conversations, I was saying there's something very common in, I mean, there's a perspective that's very, that they share.
Congruent, really.
Congruent. And what it was they were both desperately committed to democracy. They cared deeply about democracy in ways that Americans have gotten out of the habit of caring about it. Yeah. But it was their, if you excuse the mixed metaphor, holy grail.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
It is what they were searching for, what they wanted desperately, and what they had committed their lives, physically and spiritually and emotionally, to achieving for themselves.
Yes.
But more importantly, for their people. Mm-hmm. And I think that story and what you've done with Tipperary is to me, bring that back to life, put it in a context that we've sort of forgotten about. We take all these things for granted, and we're paying the price for taking it for granted. But that sense of the importance, the core root importance of that ultimately myth, that is the democratic, that people can govern themselves, is very, very important.
It's where the soul is. It's where the soul resides. I mean, the point about this book, Tipperary, is that when the hero is born, the year 1860, which is when really the modern Ireland we know today begins, 85% of the land is owned by 15% of the people. The native people who have been on this island for 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years were completely dispossessed in order to provide a Protestant people for a Protestant monarch. Perfectly understandable politically, but not understandable democratically. Now, you raise a very interesting point, Bill, which is something that concerns me. And it concerned me all when I was writing Tipperary. I refuse to believe that people will not go on rebelling and having revolutions. And I can anticipate a revolution in the United States that is based entirely on a new kind of democracy, and that is the democracy of the right to have something. The democracy of the right to carve in to the pie, and this is not socialism, this is not communism, nothing of those things, but there are now super rich people, and they're now, by comparison, therefore, super poor people. It is out of balance, and it has gone out of balance rapidly. Within the last 15 years, it has gone completely out of balance.
And visibly.
And visibly. And you will know about it in the South more than I will know about it on the East Coast, where I live in a very prosperous community in Connecticut, which is the second most prosperous state in the Union, I believe. I see that democratization process taking many forms and going on and going on and going on. And if you want to see how that happened over the ages, over the centuries, Ireland is a terrific model.
Absolutely.
It was also, do we need to...
I was going to let us go away, but go ahead, and then we'll do it.
Well, I want to go back to Tibet. The reason I mention that is one of the people, actually both people, Tibet is a challenge for a lot of reasons. Tibetan people want to be free.
Yes.
They have an interesting...
They are free. They want to assert their freedom, is the way they put it.
That's right.
independence or
autonomy, lots of
different ways of describing it. One of the differences and one of the interesting things is, A, the perspective is a different cultural perspective from at least at first blush, from what we're accustomed to. And they also have a charismatic leader who's stunningly intelligent, worldly wise, lots of different kinds of things. But I found myself reading your book simultaneously with reading these other books about the history of Tibet, but also the how to get out of this mess. And it seems to me the lessons, I mean, they're arguing for, at least some of them were arguing for a Buddhist capitalism, a Buddhist democracy, but not a theocracy, but predicated on those principles. And when we come back, the exploration of democracy, it seems, is central. The Irish perspective, the Tibetan perspective, the American perspective, and ultimately the world perspective.
I want to talk about that.
And we all will talk about freedom when we return in a moment.